This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
They used to be regular guests in our homes, anytime we chose, entertaining us when we switched on our radio and television sets. Now it's time to hear again the voices that came out of the glow. A very good day to you this afternoon, Steve Price and Paul F., hoping that you'll stay with us and perhaps find something to your liking in our second broadcast for August. Here's a familiar tune from the TV screen. No prizes for guessing what that came from. Of course, the theme to It's in the Bag, Selwyn Toogood's TV quiz. And here's the man himself in his afternoon panel show, Beauty and the Beast. For John Newman in Burnside. Afternoon to you, John.
Good afternoon and welcome to Beauty and the Beast, a programme where we discuss your problems. On today's panel, Mary McNichol, Jill Ritchie, Shona McFarlane, Nancy King, and your host, Selwyn Toogood.
Hello, New Zealand, and a very, very happy new year to you all from all of us here on Beauty and the Beast. We've got a very good panel this week. They've pressed up pretty well after a pretty torrid New Year's Eve. From way up in the top of the South Island, we have Mary McNichol, who lives in the Marlborough Sounds. Mary, nice to have you back on the programme. From Dunedin, Jill Ritchie. Now, Jill, for you viewers who didn't see her when she appeared on the programme early, is blind. She works in the X-ray department of the Dunedin Public Hospital. She's in the dark room, appropriately enough. And from Dunedin, Shona McFarlane, writer, painter, singer, dancer, yes, you do the lot, don't
right.
you?
Juggling.
And a juggler. Right. And from Dunedin, Nancy King. We've had Nancy on the programme, very well known in the world of sport in New Zealand. Nice to see you back. Our first letter comes from Disturbed of the Waikato. Recently in a chain store, while waiting to be served, I saw a boy of about four come to his mother with a wrapped sweet in his hand. His mother told him to put it back, and when he refused, she said, "Well, only one." And off they went, making no effort to pay for it. I thought the child should be told that you pay for everything in a shop or you put it back. The ultimate homemaker of the year will be flying to Paris. Will it be you?
A spot for Ultimate and an extract from a broadcast of Beauty and the Beast, both with Selwyn Toogood. Another cut now from Shelley Berman. the US comedian much played on NZBC radio of the 1960s. With that, greetings go to Jim Smart of Papua Nui. Getting through those DVDs, Jim? Then you're doing better than I am, I'll have to say. Also, hello to Bob Gant in Church Corner. Pleased to have finally met you a few months back.
I discovered this afternoon why I don't like buttermilk. Now, I'm going to get into that because, first of all, I'm not the kind of a guy who forms a snap judgment about some white, innocent fluid. And again, it seems to me that people who do like buttermilk love buttermilk beyond anything in existence. They have a thing over buttermilk, which I won't go into detail about. It's a little pornographic. I have seen people drinking buttermilk in a way that makes me feel that I just shouldn't be watching. So naturally, I thought about this for a couple of years, and you can imagine how desperate a man has to be to think about buttermilk, you know, for a prolonged period. Anything over 10 minutes has got to be paranoid, you know. Anyway, this afternoon, for some inexplicable reason, I saw the light. I had a revelation. I'll tell you what I had. I had a satori. That's for those of you who believe in Zen. And I have a feeling the room is loaded with Zen people tonight. I'll tell you what Zen is. Zen is a kind of philosophical, metaphysical thought thing. You have it so far? It's a kind of offshoot of Buddhism in which, through concentration, you arrive at certain levels of existence, and you are capable of answering certain very tricky questions. One of the questions is this. You know the sound of two hands clapping, but what is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, I know that sound. I've heard it frequently enough, God knows, and I'm not going to dwell on it because I'll cry, and a comedian, you know, should be jolly. Anyway, I was telling you about buttermilk, why I don't like it. I found out today, and I'm going to tell it to you. It is not the buttermilk that bothers me. It's the way the glass looks when you're through drinking it that makes me sick. That ugly white map inside of that glass. 2 more seconds and I'll throw up. I know it. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to this catharsis. It was something I had to get off my chest. I'm glad you were here to hear it. Now, because you were kind, before going into our next thing, I will reward you. I will reward you all with a little game. This is a little game that you can play with yourselves. That is, of course, if you're inclined to do that sort of thing. The game is called Nostalgics. There are words or groups of words, the mention of which or the seeing of them in print recalls for me an area of my existence which has been sweet and warm and quietly thrilling, like returning to the womb. And let's face it, we all want to go back, you know. How many of us sleep in a fetal position, you know, let's fess up. Anyway, I want to get off the subject because it is disgusting, and I'd like to do something else. I'll tell you about nostalgia. Here's a few examples. For example, the word skate key sets me into a frenzy of remembering, or the phrase, I will trade you a Batman for a Captain Marvel, which, of course, appeals only to the intellectuals. But let's see what this does for you. Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. It gets you where you live, huh?
Ye gods, I have Boardwalk and Park Place.
It's, you know what it is? It's that surge of thrill you get when you know you've wiped out a friend. That's the...
Shelley Berman on the radio again from the album Inside Shelley Berman. Through the Doors, an hour of picks from the Doors catalogue.
Paul Featherston introduces live and studio tracks, covers, interviews, commentary, documentary recordings, and readings.
Plains FM, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Join a past panellist of mine, Steve Bell and myself, for that programme devoted to The Doors. Also available on the website plainsfm.org.nz. It's all about a Texas Marshal in parade on Out of the Glow this time.
Parade! A cavalcade of people, places, and memorable events. In 1881, El Paso, Texas was a wide-open, rip-roaring town. It was in that year that a tall, blue-eyed former Texas Ranger named Dallas Studenmeyer rode into town and sought out the city council.
Gentlemen, I hear tell you're looking for a new marshal. I'm your man.
The city fathers thought so too and appointed him on the spot. And any doubts in the minds of the wilder element about Studenmeyer's ability were dispelled soon afterwards when a man on trial for murder cut loose into the courthouse with a smuggled gun.
You won't give no more false evidence against me, I'm telling you!
Bystanders ducked for cover as the accused man, John Hale, shot dead a prosecution witness, only to find himself looking into the steel-blue eyes of the town marshal. Studenmeyer, who wore his Colt 45 not in holsters but in leather-lined hip pockets, didn't waste time discussing the situation with Hale. The marshal was unscathed. One of his shots had killed a gaping Mexican witness by mistake. Another ended the life of John Hale. A third disposed of one of Hale's friends who joined in the fight. Four men dead inside 30 seconds. As one citizen put it,
"Evening, old El Paso, that's news. For a day or so, anyway."
Dallas Studenmeyer was established as a man to be feared, and very quickly El Paso became a pretty quiet and peaceful place. He made enemies, of course. Gamblers, saloon owners, they hated him. But nobody had the nerve to do much about it. He was, everyone agreed, the gunfighter to end all. Yet, when the end came for Dallas Studenmeyer, it came, ironically, because he forgot two classic rules of the gunfight, now common knowledge among keen students of the Old West. It happened when the marshal, by now a federal government lawman, walked into a saloon to beard the brothers Manning, with whom he'd had an old feud.
Howdy, Marshal. Have a drink. On the house.
Manning. You've been telling lies about me. You're a liar and a skunk.
Why, you...
Manning, stung by the insult, went for his gun, and the two men fired almost together. Each wounded in the right arm dropped his weapon, and as Studenmeyer tried to draw his second 45, Manning flung himself at him.
No, you don't! Go on, me, and fight like a man!
Manning's arms were around the marshal's body and left arm, and despite his wound, he clung on desperately, preventing Studenmeyer from drawing his gun. How it would have ended had they been left alone, nobody can guess. In fact, it was Manning's brother coming in at that moment behind Studenmeyer who stopped the fight. Dallas Studenmeyer, the most feared lawman El Paso had ever known, fell dead. and the mistakes he made? One, he let his enemy get within arm's reach of him. And two, he went after two men without making sure he knew just where both of them were. You have been listening to the dramatization of a true story from the pages of the National Monthly Magazine, Parade.
In September, we're to hear about Nell Gwynn and Pocahontas in Parade. Out of the Glow is about melodies and moments from broadcasting history.
Ohio River, the Stoned Ranger.
This is Paul Featherstone, inviting you to tune to an hour of comedy, featured artists, personalities, and sports coverage on Plains FM 96.9, the first two Sundays of the month at 5 p.m.
There's the dropout by Oxley. It won't go over the 25. He's trying to kick it along the line.
Steve Price is panelling, and this is Paul Featherstone. A good day to the McNaughtons. Grace and Brian at Brightstone Crescent, and Ted Moore of Rangiora. Hello to you. We go over to the Ryman Auditorium for a few minutes now, joining Hank Snow, the Willis Brothers, and Tex Ritter on a broadcast of the Grand Ole Opry.
Presenting the Grand Ole Opry. Let her go, boys.
This is Hal Durham inviting you to join us now at the Grand Ole Opry, coming to you from the nation's center of country music, Nashville, Tennessee. Featured on this portion of our show are Hank Snow, the Willis Brothers, Tex Ritter, Margie Bowes, Justin Tubb, and Marion Worth. Now, here's the singing ranger, Hank Snow.
From old Montana down to Alabama, I've been before and I'll travel again. You driving with me can't keep a good man down. He's done the cars, but you missed a play. Now hit the road and be on your way. I'm gonna pull the golden rocket and leave this town. With a good engine running on time, but baby, I'm switching to another line. So honey, never hang your signal out for me. I'm tired of running on the same old track. I bought a one-way ticket and I won't be back. This golden rock is gonna roll my blues away. So blow that UQM, but now you know that they got another turtle that's waiting in Tennessee. There's a midnight special, the burn of the rail, so I don't try to follow my trail. It's a golden rock, it's gonna roll your blues away. Hear a thunder on through the night, this golden rock, it isn't doing me right, and the sunny old Southland sure is a part of me. Now from your call, but erase the name, you'll find out you're the lost, you're blaming this golden rock and rolling my blues away. Talk to me. That old conductor, he seemed to know that you done me wrong, I was feeling low. Yelled aloud, we're over that Dixon line. Well, the brakeman started singing a song, said you're worried now that it won't be long. This golden rock is gonna roll your blues behind. Now, Jimmy. Greet the newborn day. When I kissed my baby in the station door, that was the blues like it never before. Of the golden rock and the roll my blues away. Yeah!
We hope that you enjoy the little program we've got prepared for you. We're going to do our very best to please you, and we've got some fine artists coming out here in just a little while. And right now, here is an example, and a good one. The Cavern Rock Brothers. The Willis Brothers. Let's make them walk.
Thank you, Hank. Somebody knows my dog.
There's a big German shepherd at my home, and he's there to guard my darling through the night. But somebody knows my dog, and when I'm gone, he gets through the fence to hold my darling tight. Somebody knows my dog, and some strangers can't get in. I know when I start looking, I must look among my friends. I travel for a living, making payments on that home. Now somebody knows my dog, and he slips in when I'm gone. I can't really blame the dog, he needs a friend. And I'm gone so much, I guess she needs one too. I could park this rig, but money won't come in. Yet somebody knows my dog, what can I do? Somebody knows my dog, and since strangers can't get in, I know when I start looking, I must look among my friends. I traveled for a living, making payments on that home. Now somebody knows my dog, and he slips in when I'm gone. It's getting so when I come to my door, that dog don't seem to know me anymore. They must have won him over when I was gone, and it's making me a stranger in my home. Somebody knows my dog, and the stranger can't get in. I know when I start looking, I must look among my friends. I travel for a living, making payments on that home. Now somebody knows my dog, and he slips in when I'm gone.
Thank you, the Willis Brothers. Well, it's a great pleasure. As a matter of fact, to me, it's always an honor to be able to introduce the act that's coming up next, Friends and Neighbors. He's been many years in the business, has his contribution has been a great one to our type of music, motion pictures, television, radio, and records. We call him America's most beloved cowboy, and he's going to do a number that is really out of this world, a beautiful number, Just Beyond the Moon, and Tex Ritter, let's make it.
My mother and my father were in love for 50 years. So when Dad died, we wondered why my mother shed no tears. We asked her once about it, but she wouldn't tell us why. Instead, she'd walk outside each night and smile up at the sky. Then just before she left us, she called us to her side. She told us what my father had said to her just before he died. I remember when you said you'd never leave me. Through these golden years, I've kept the same vow too. Now that I am going, please don't leave me. I'll walk just beyond the moon, then I'll stop and wait for you. You can look up every night, and you'll see me light the light, where I'll watch for you to join me someday soon. We'll go looking through the stars for the heaven that is ours, and I know we'll find it soon, somewhere just beyond the moon. Sit there by a star, and I'll watch you from afar, till I see you walking toward me someday soon. Then together, hand in hand, we'll find our promised land, and we'll settle down forever, darling, just beyond the moon. I'll walk just beyond the moon, then I'll stop and wait for you.
We're back this moment with Mike Chester to continue his story.
Please, put your arms around me. Kiss me.
What?
Kiss me.
That's how it began. A foggy night, a lurking peril, and a lovely girl who was too young to die.
Mike? Mike, you all right?
Quiet, Jan. I'm okay.
Why'd you switch the light off?
That shot came through the window. I'm trying to see. Yes, there he goes.
Who?
I can't tell. He was up on the roof of that empty house across the street. He's getting into a car.
Is he alone?
Looks like it. Carrying a rifle. Some high-powered job, I'd say, from the way Blaney dropped when it hit him. Can't even see much of the car. It's too dark out there. I'm sorry to leave you tied up there, Jan, but I wanted to be sure.
Sure of what?
Let's get these ropes off now. Got to get out of here.
Markridge must have heard the shot. He'll be up here any second.
I doubt it. The sound naturally came from outside the house. He wouldn't connect it to this room. We'd better get moving just the same. There you are.
Oh, it's ropes. My arm hurts.
Here, let me massage your wrists.
Mike, what about Blaney? Is he...
He's dead. My guess is he was dead before he hit the floor.
Oh.
Don't let it worry you. Blaney was a hood of the worst kind.
Oh, I'm not worried, not about Blaney, but... Mike, perhaps that bullet was meant for you.
No.
Well, how can you be sure? That might be one of Blaney's crowd out there watching us.
There. Your arms feel better now?
Oh, much better, thanks. Well, how do you know, Mike?
There's a fire escape outside this window. It might be better if... What was that? How do I know what?
That someone wasn't trying to kill you.
I told you, the gunman had a high-powered rifle. He wouldn't load himself up with an awkward weapon like that unless he meant to hit exactly what he was aiming at. Probably used a telescopic sight.
But you were fighting with Blaney, moving around the room.
We weren't moving at the moment the shot was fired, and the bullet hit Blaney right over the heart. No, Jan, that gunman meant to kill Blaney and no one else.
But who? I mean, why Blaney? Another crook wouldn't...
We can talk about it later. Come on. We've got to get out of here. Throw a few things in a small case. You'll have to leave the rest.
I'm not coming back here?
Are you kidding? Somebody's bound to call the police about that shot. And there's Blaney. How are you going to explain the body?
All right, I'll get some things.
Can you manage without the light on? I don't want people to see it from the street, especially with the window broken.
I'll manage.
Good. Well, make it fast, darling. We may have even less time than we think.
Mockridge, you're not being very helpful.
I'm doing the best I can, Inspector.
I'd like to believe that.
This has all been a great shock to me, you know. I've never had anything like this in my lodging house before, and that's a fact. It's all a bit disconcerting.
You said you heard what sounded like a shot. You left your room downstairs and went outside and looked about.
That's right. Mind you, I wasn't sure it was a shot, but I was curious-like.
What did you see outside?
Nothing. I thought I heard a car drive off fast up the street at the side of the house, you know, but... was out of sight when I got there.
So you went back inside to your room?
That's right.
You didn't think to come upstairs here and speak to anyone about the shot?
Now, why should I do that? I told you the sound came from outside the house.
The bullet that was fired killed a man in one of your rooms.
Oh, I know that now. But how could I know it then? It's a shocking thing, you know. I've never had anything like this in my lodging house, never.
You didn't know the dead man?
Never set eyes on him, and that's a fact.
And the girl in whose room he was found?
Miss Carter.
That's right, Miss Jan Carter.
Yeah. You seem to know more than I do, Inspector. Come to think of it, you got here almost before anyone had rung the police. Bit of a rum go, that.
This whole affair is very much of a rum go, Mr. Mockridge. What happened to Jan Carter?
Your guess is as good as mine, as they say.
Did Mr. Chester tell you anything about her?
Mr. Who?
Chester. Michael Chester. He recommended the girl to you as a lodger. He asked you to give her a room.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Mr. Chester didn't send Jan Carter to you?
Chester, did you say? I don't seem to know the name. The girl just walked in and asked for a room. She seemed all right, you know, just like any other young lass. So I gave her the room.
Mm-hmm. And you don't know Michael Chester?
I just said so, didn't I?
That's curious.
What is?
Well, you wondered how I got here so quickly. That happened because I was with Michael Chester's wife. She told me that her husband had gone to see Jan Carter, who had taken a room somewhere on Chester's recommendation.
Oh. Well,
and Mrs.
Chester
recalled that a Mr. Mockridge phoned her husband one evening and left his phone number, which happens to be your phone number, Mr. Mockridge.
Look, Inspector, Mike asked me to... Well, and not to talk about it, like...
Lying to the police could get you into a lot of trouble, Mockridge.
Well, I didn't think that part mattered, you see.
Well, I'll be the judge of what matters. Now, let's go over your story again.
All right, if you want to. But it's all true, Inspector. All except that part about Mike Chester. I didn't see anything, and I don't know where the girl is right now.
Perhaps not. But we'll go over the story just the same. Now, you heard the shot.
Go ahead, Jen.
All right. But I still don't see the point of coming here to your flat, Mike.
It's the only place I can think of at short notice. We'll have to find another place for you, of course.
But the police will question Mockridge and find I've disappeared, leaving Blenny dead in my room. They'll be looking for me.
Well, they won't look here.
How can you say that? They might connect it through Mockridge. He knows you got me in that room at his place.
Okay, so the police might want to talk to me, and they'll look for me at Eve's place. That's still officially my home.
Well, I still say...
All right, Jan, maybe you're right. There's nowhere else at the moment, and don't forget... The police haven't been chasing you very hard lately.
Well, they only wanted me for carrying contraband or something. Perhaps knocking down that sergeant, but this is murder.
Blaney? Hardly likely to blame you for that.
He was killed in my room, Mike.
They'll know he was shot by someone outside the house. The police aren't that dumb.
Well, they'll still want to question me. I'm what is it, a material witness, isn't it?
Seems to me you've been studying up your law books.
Don't joke, Mike. This is serious.
I know. So serious that I'd better get back to Eve's place and see what the police have to say.
Well, I think it's dangerous. I mean to go looking for them.
Nobody saw me at Mockridge's tonight. I don't have to know anything.
You said Eve was there when I phoned you. Well, she must know you went somewhere.
Yes, but she doesn't know where. Anyway, for all she or anyone knows, you could have left Mockridge's before I got there.
I still don't like the idea of staying here.
Look. That window over there gives you a good view of the street. Now, if it'll make you feel any better and you think that you can keep awake, you can sit over there and watch out for the police.
All right, but what if they come?
You can slip out down the back stairs. But they won't come at all. That's my bet.
I don't bet. I never did have gambler's luck.
Anyway, if they aren't here within the next couple of hours, you can give up waiting.
When will you be back, Mike?
As soon as I can, you know that. I'll have to see what's happened and shake off the police. So don't worry if I'm not back at all tonight.
Inspector Charlton, it's hours since you left here. I've been wondering what happened.
Is your husband home again yet, Mrs. Chester?
Mike? No, he's not back.
Oh, do you mind if I come in and wait for him?
Well, what makes you think he'll be back at all?
That would take a long time to explain. May I come in?
Of course. You went to Mockridge's?
Yes, naturally. Unfortunately, I was a little behind the fare.
How do you mean?
Well, that was where your husband was bound, all right. That was where Jan Carter lived.
Lived?
Past tense.
And Mike, where is he then?
I don't know.
You didn't see him?
No.
Had he gone to that address?
Oh, I don't think you need worry about him. Looks very much as though he and the girl got away from Mockridge's before the killing.
Killing?
Oh, yes, you don't know about that, of course. A man we've identified as a crook named Blaney was shot to death at Mockridge's.
Blaney?
You've heard of him? Oh, yes, of course, you mentioned the name.
Mike told me about him. He was the man who went to Mike's flat that morning and pretended to be a policeman. At least the man called himself by that name.
Hmm.
He's dead, you say?
Yes, shot. And I don't look so worried, Mrs. Chester. I doubt if your husband shot him.
Of course not. I didn't think for a minute...
Didn't you? Not even when you know your husband has a pistol? And that Jan Carter's life might have been endangered by this Blaney?
Mike is not a murderer, Inspector.
No,
and I resent...
Come, Mrs. Chester. No theatricals, please. I think you and I understand each other better than that.
I don't know what you mean.
I mean, we both know a good deal about your husband's character. He's a man who's had to fight his way out of trouble many times in the past.
If you're talking about the years he spent as a newspaper correspondent overseas...
Exactly. In all the trouble spots imaginable. I'm not at all sure that shooting Blaney wouldn't be in character for Michael Chester.
You have no right to...
Assuming that the life of someone he loved was in danger.
Someone he loved?
However, since Blaney was not killed by a pistol, but with a powerful rifle...
How dare you?
How dare I what?
You have the effrontery to assume that my husband is having an affair with some other woman.
And he isn't.
I think I've had enough of your impertinence, Inspector. I must ask you to leave.
Quiet. Seems you have another visitor.
Mike!
Hey.
Come in, Mr. Chester. We were just talking about you. Come in and join the discussion. It should prove quite interesting.
I stood at the door looking at my wife and the inspector. A cold shiver shook me for a moment. I had deliberately come back to find out what the police were doing, yet finding Inspector Charlton already there made me wonder if what I was doing was really going to help Jan Carter, the girl who was too young to die.
Through the Doors, an hour of picks from the Doors catalogue.
Paul Featherston introduces live and studio tracks, covers, interviews, commentary, documentary recordings, and readings.
Plains FM, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Mary Wilson called the following poem simply Oxford. Young voices echo from the walls along the teeming high. Peak upon peak, St. Mary soars against the summer sky. And hesitating Merton clock chimes out each quarter hour, and strong and clear the time swings back from nearby Magdalen Tower. How thick and green the sherwell glides beneath a willow tree, where in a punt a student lies, his book upon his knees, struggling to cram his tired brain. Finals loom over all, yet pausing every now and then to hear the cuckoo call. And in that cooing cry he hears with pleasure and with pain the music of those 3 short years he will not know again. Welcome back to Chris McCabe, our concert goer. How are you doing too, Lee O'Connor of Breezes Road, Aranui? Greetings also to Lorna and Wilf Metzger in Lynwood.
Today we're going to listen to the Manhattan Transfer, which I saw on Remembrance Day 1978 in the Christchurch Town Hall. Now remember, 78, the building had been standing for about 5 or 6 years, and this was in the main auditorium. A quartet, and it's 1981 recording that we'll use. We're going to hear 1975 release of Tuxedo Junction, Boy from New York City, came out in 1981, and Trickle Trickle, which I love it because it's so upbeat, and then probably one of their most well-known and popular songs ever, Operator, and that came out in 1975.
Oh,
They started in 1969, and their name, The Manhattan Transfer, came from a John Dos Passos novel. To my knowledge, the group is still going, and they're firmly jazz-based.
Information. Information. Information.
Manhattan Transfer, as I said, saw them in 1978. Can't remember too much about them other than that they were slick.
Thank you for that, Chris. Thanks very much indeed. And when Chris McCabe returns in September, we'll have on The Coasters. We're off again, but return the first Sunday in September with The Hollies, Elvis again on the Louisiana Hayride, The Two Ronnies, and Edward Jenner, A Name to Remember. You take care, and here's hoping life will be looking up for you. Bye. Out of the Glow is an Ear Media presentation recorded at WebMad Christchurch.